Hi there, and welcome to Ungagged Interviews with Neil Anderson. This time, I am interviewing Councillor Matt Kerr from Glasgow City Council, and we talk about unions and strikes and people's influence, Brexit, Scottish independence, and the City of London. It is a fascinating listen. But first, listen to Rufus G and Drive By.
Take a look around the energy, self-destruction and poverty, and yeah, it's got worse as a decline of the economy. It was here before the recession, it in some kind of anomaly. Government never invested in youth, so they stunted morally. Libraries and community centres all closed down, so the roads is where you find most of our youth now. Getting street educated by the elders around, in at the deep end, so they learn how to drown. Losing friends as they grow, so they know about grief. In and out of road wars, so they know about beef. Different days, same drama, so they don't see peace. Products are an environment created by MPs. Lack of opportunities make them lose hope. Hardly any jobs, so they hustle and rope. Trying hard to survive and find it hard to cope. Living the only way they can on a slippery slope.
Yeah. Out of sight, shouldn't mean out of mind. You'll be surprised when you find. Take a glimpse of the answer from my eyes. And look deeper when you drive.
We all need to survive, so we find a way. How can you provide for your family on a minor wage? And when you work three jobs just to boost your pay, days turn to night, nights turn to day. Working to the bone just to climb out of poverty. Kids grow up not knowing their rent's full of animosity. Then you stare at the wrangle on roads, start doing robberies and build a rep to gain respect. On these mucky streets looking for the love and attention that they crave. Couldn't get it at home but found something unpaid. And the aim becomes to be top dog on the estate as they follow on the path to the cage or the grave. Cause they grow up without any boundaries or support, and it seems the only thing they recognize is being poor. The life seems empty, so they always want more, but they can never find what it is they're looking for. Live a life full of pain and suffering, no option, born into hard times struggling. Learn to survive and make pee from hustling, so don't be surprised when they're grown. It's a gully ting.
Out of sight shouldn't mean out of mind. You'll be surprised when you find. Take a glimpse of the answer from my eyes. And look deeper when you drive by.
On the high rise stairs, you'll see fiends on the pipe. Women out all hours, cause they're ladies of the night. Youngest carry straps, cause they're eager for stripes. And the government ignores the situation like they're blind. Raising the taxes and lowering benefits, making it harder for families who are struggling. Keep the rich rich seems to be their prerogative, forcing the poor to be even more impoverished. And people will do what it is they have to do. The crime rate will rise and it will go through the roof. Double the music and games, but it's all an excuse. The establishment calls the situation is the truth. Politicians only listen to funds they campaign. Society will fall cause things will never change. The rich and poor divide will exaggerate. The nation will decline and fall into decay. So dear Prime Minister, could you get a clue? Look what you're doing to the poor and the youth. You need to make changes cause they're long overdue. Start listening to the people instead of ignoring the views.
I am here in Glasgow City Chambers with Councillor Matt Kerr, and going to ask him a few questions and see what the responses are. So the first one is, you've been a councillor in Glasgow City Council for a while. One of the committees you are on is Just Transitions. I realise with the new council and with recent events that maybe the committee hasn't started meeting yet, but what are your proposals, your ideas about what you want to do in this committee?
Well, my hopes for it are that we will. I mean, the biggie in Glasgow is transport. Right? So we need to take some serious steps forward on that. And our biggest barrier, in my view, to getting the kind of transition needed transport-wise in Glasgow is the ownership of the buses. I know sometimes people say, well, you can throw money at the problem, you can do this, that, or the other, or you can regulate them. I think ultimately you don't have any real control over it until we own it, because at the moment we are heavily subsidising buses to convert their engines. We're heavily subsidising buses through free bus passes as well. Mm-hmm. People sometimes forget that. Massive sums of money going into these companies. And I would rather see that money kept in the public realm, kept in the common wheel, and then reinvested back into expanding services, because the problem we've got right now is the services basically run either where they're receiving a big subsidy or where they're making money, and we play both sides of that. And I think if we had a public operator that would be able to cross-subsidise, it would be able to provide more socially useful routes than maybe we are right now. There's a lot of communities in this city that are just chronically underutilised. And if you think where I am in the southwest of the city, there's effectively a whole town has been built over in the back of Pollock, Darnley and all the rest of it. Thousands and thousands of houses, all with, you know, two-car driveways and a really poor bus service. So, I mean, I think we need to think about that.
Definitely.
We need to think about that. That's really basic stuff, I think, but we need to get the basic stuff right. And that needs to filter into our planning. So we want to see a powerful committee that is influencing planning in the next city plan. So that's something to get started with, I would think.
Excellent. That fits in just on a personal note with me on so many levels, with my political leanings and being member of Glasgow Trades Council, and we're going for that as well. So that is
I neglected to mention bikes, which are my passion as well, but that's another story. anything that makes it easier to cycle in the city, and there's been a lot of progress made over the last decade. The number of people riding the bike into work or just riding the city just for pleasure or just to go to the shops. But you could see, I remember when I was first elected 15 years ago, when I used to ride my bike in. And I would see maybe a couple of guys in bikes, and it would be guys.
Yeah.
guys in bikes on the way in. And now when I do it, it's dozens and dozens. Yeah. And so you can see it, you can feel it, and I think the city's a better place for it. It's safer for pedestrians. And okay, there's sometimes a wee bit of conflict between pedestrians and cyclists, but I think it's just, it makes for a happier, safer city. Yeah. I don't think we talk about happiness enough.
You're totally correct.
Anyway,
sorry. That's what people want to be.
Yes, it would be nice.
Life is to be happy, and yeah, it's not, because I don't know. Totally correct. Right, okay, back to our next formal question.
All right.
Met you a few weeks ago on the CWU picket line at BT offices in Glasgow.
Uh-huh.
And of course, so BT and certainly Openreach and the posties have been in the strike as well. Mm-hmm. You were a postie yourself.
I was, yes. Uh-huh. 14 years, man and boy.
Uh-huh. So what are your thoughts on this summer or coming into autumn of discontent?
Summer or autumn, and it'll be winter soon. I mean, funny thing about that, my dad reminds me every year that I was born in the middle of the winter of discontent. So I have mixed feelings about it. But look, this has been a long time coming where we are.
Yep.
This hasn't just happened this summer.
No.
We've had decades now of stagnant wage growth, if you want to call it growth at all, but stagnant wages. Decades of attacks on workers' rights with very little pushback, if we're honest. And actually, the unions over a huge period of that time have got weaker. We need to level with ourselves on that.
Mm-hmm. And partly due to government legislation.
Oh, absolutely. That was quite a conscious thing. Thatcher done something very clever. She privatised housing, made it easier for people to get in debt, and people who are in debt and have mortgages are very much less likely to go on strike.
Yep.
So it was a very much a conscious step on her behalf. I mean, people think it was some great move for freedom. It's quite the opposite. It's about removing freedoms and creating wage slaves, which is effectively what happened. and that undermined the trade union movement, it undermined the membership. But I'm glad to see that like, trade union membership has started to turn the corner, it's started to creep back up again. Which is, but it's more than that. Trade union members are getting more involved because it's one thing having millions of members, and it's quite another thing having millions of members who are active. And the one thing, obviously, advice I'd always give everyone is join a union, join a union, whichever union, you know, there's plenty to pick from, but join a union. But get active in it. Don't sit on the sidelines and wait for and wait for the next ballot to come out. If you go along to a branch meeting, get involved, or you can get involved in other ways if meetings aren't a thing, you know. But get involved. It's really really important. I think trade unions are a really important organ of a democracy.
Definitely. I've noticed that in the stuff that I've been doing that is more young people getting involved,
really encouraging,
which is fantastic.
Yeah, and it's not and young people who want to do something, right? So it's not just young people who, you know, are trying to carve a way out, carve a career for themselves, which occasionally happens, right? You know,
it does exactly.
But it's young people who actually want to do something, want to change the world, and want to start here. And I think that's as good a place to good a way to be as any, and it's just it really augurs well for the future. Because there was a period of time there where I know even in my own union, there's actually, and I was speaking to Dave Ward actually a few months back, and he was talking about a generational change having to take place within even within CWU, because there's a group of people, if you like, that are his sort of age, and then there was a sort of a gap, and now there's a kind of young blood coming through, and the young blood that's coming through in CWU is amazing. So I've got very high hopes. So we can see it in our telecoms branch. With Anton, he can see he's excellent, really excellent organizer. And you know that, and we forget that BT hasn't been on strike for 25 years. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal.
It's
a very tough place. Although they've got high union membership, it's a tough place to organise a strike because a lot of the engineers now are effectively lone workers. It wasn't like back in the day where my dad was a telecom engineer, when they'd all go down to the telephone exchange in the morning and then get their chitty about wherever they're going, and all of a sudden pick up their gear and off they went. It's not like that now. The van sits outside the house and they get something through, you know, through the, I was going to say pager, but it makes me feel old. But you know, something through their tablet, whatever, and it sends them off to where the job is.
Yeah.
So it's a very different kind of job. Mm. And organising strikes amongst our workforce like that, it's so dispersed is naturally more difficult. But it was excellent. It was really, and I think BT got a bit of a fright on that because it was enormously well organised. So we say and organised by people at Anton. And we've got you know, in the call centre side of things, we've got people like Carolyn, who's again, a brilliant young active as well. Again, a national striker.
Carolyn who?
That's terrible. I am terrible setting it. It'll come to me. Sorry.
We'll put it in later.
Right, no, sorry about that. Sorry, Carolyn.
End of that
bit. But, you know, we've got, so, you know, the point, organising, again, that was a national strike in call centres.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't happen.
No.
As far as I'm aware, that's the first time that's happened in this country. And so that's a very big deal indeed. And it was, again, very, very well supported. Yes, we had arrangements in place for, there were arrangements in place to make sure 999 was covered and things like that. Right? Oh. So there were some concessions, if you like, on that score, which I think people would generally accept. But it was enormously well organised, well observed. And I think really effective. I think it was a shot across the bows that the BT were not expecting. Probably didn't expect the strike to be half as solid as it was. Royal Mail, which is kind of my old stomping ground, we're not shy about the strike in the Royal Mail. I mean, I used to be in the government delivery office, and to be honest, it was under. We were rather strike prone. It wasn't official strikes, yes. You know. To be honest, but. A lot of what goes on, and it was as clear to me 20 years ago in Govan as it is now. And it's speaking to Cumbria, I mean, I've been out with the post office now for 10 years, I've been there for 10 years now. But the management culture in that company hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. And there've been umpteen, I mean, government reports go back to when it was state owned, mm-hmm. like the Sawyer report, if you remember Tom Sawyer, the other half. sat in the House of Lords, I believe now. Anyway, but you know, there were all sorts of reports about management culture in the Royal Mail about the culture of bullying, intimidation, and all this, and it hasn't changed. And I have to say, there's kind of two sides to that. There's the pressure that the posties themselves get put under by the line managers, but actually, there's the bit as well. The line managers themselves are being put under an enormous, and you know, it rolls downhill, as they say.
That kind of pressure always starts from the top.
Absolutely, because it's a culture, that's how culture can change in an organisation like that. And it clearly has been no great will to really change it. There's been reports, but nothing's ever really been done. I mean, I've actually seen managers have breakdowns and things like that. You don't see that happening anyway, you know. But you see the pressure they're getting put under every day, and that say that the posties themselves are being asked to do more and more for less than, you know, for less recognition, to be honest with you, in real terms. And I think that when I started in the Royal Mail, sound very old now again, but we used to started at 5:15 in the morning. Mm-hmm. We were expected to deliver our first letter. Some people find this hard to believe, maybe some younger listeners. We were expected to deliver our first letter by 7:30.
Yep.
You were expected to do that. If you didn't do it, you were expected to answer for why that didn't happen. You were expected to finish your first delivery by 9:35, so you could get back to the office to prepare your second delivery. And if you hadn't delivered your last letter at 9:35, and you went back, and people obviously thought you were skiving from the sort of second delivery, but the point was, people had their mail at a reasonable hour. Uh-huh. And oddly enough, every bit of so-called modernisation and progress that's come through that company has made the mail later and later and later.
Yeah.
And it's not improved the service one iota. The liberalisation that people largely through the EU, right enough, the liberalisation of the postal market, which was pushed by an EU commissioner called Lord Mandelson. I'm not a fan. And my maiden speech in this chamber was actually criticising Lord Mandelson when he was trying to privatise the Royal Mail.
Yes.
Not an appalling individual. I'm being gentle there. But anyway, I don't have a lot of time for the man. But they pushed the liberalisation of the postal market. We actually, up until the liberalisation of the postal market in this country, we had the cheapest, fastest mail system in Europe.
Mm. Right.
And you think how much prices have gone up now, and how much later you get your stuff now. And everybody's queuing up to get stuff from the delivery offices because it's not there in time before they left for work or whatever. I mean, everything's just become more complicated because of this pointless market. Mm-hmm. During lockdown, actually, I was conscious of this. People talk about modernisation. I like to talk about the inefficiencies of the market. Do you think, and actually two aspects that CWU are active in here. One, postal services. Yes, parcels were always open to the market, had been since the early 80s. That's right, a long time story, but it's been in place a long time. But it certainly became more liberalised.
Uh-huh.
And as did the mail. And the result is, everybody was sitting at home during COVID and looking at the window. The only people we would see quite often are people coming to the door delivering things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But how many vans did you have on your street?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have? I mean, you went from maybe having two, you know, maybe a couple, to having dozens sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem to me to be a very effective way, especially if we're trying to be conscious about things like climate change, and efficient use of fuels. Does it make sense having six vans on the road or one? I mean, I think it's. This should be, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this should be a monopoly, and if it's a monopoly, it should be in public control, anything, end of story. And the other one is as a local councillor, I get lots of complaints about the states of pavements, as you might imagine.
Yep.
But there's parts of my ward I've had the pavements dug up three times in the last 12 months.
Yep.
Why have they had them dug up three times in the last 12 months? Because three separate companies want to lay down fibre optic cables. Now, we could have an argument about who the different providers might be and all this. Again, I don't think there's any need for multiple providers, but anyway. But the point is, you only need one cable. It doesn't matter, you could have 300 different providers out there. You only need one cable. That's the whole point of fibre optics.
Uh-huh.
But we're having the streets dug up and wrecked for three different sets of cables being put down, and each one of them is getting subsidy from the state. Each one of these private companies doing it because it's part of the broadband rollout.
Yeah.
How utterly stupid is that? How inefficient is that?
And I think, certainly for me, the same applied to other previously publicly owned industries or nationalised industries, like electricity and gas. And certainly, I certainly think with that, if we had still had publicly owned electricity and gas, we could go and tell these suppliers like BP and Shell, no, get lost. We're not paying your world market price. We're buying for the whole of this country. This is the price that we want.
I mean, I think you're right. And you could go a bit further and just, I mean, we used to own 51% of BP.
Yeah.
You know? Imagine if we still did. I mean, see, these things are not only useful in terms of, obviously, people are looking at the situation right now in terms of prices and rightly worried about it and rightly looking at and seeing the absolute greed and the monstrosity of the market. But at the same time, you think, if you're actually serious about just transition, to jump back to the last question, I suppose, although I don't suppose a council committee can really organise this, but it's certainly agitating.
You can certainly promote it.
I mean, just think how much easier it would be to actually organise and plan that transition in such a way that it was genuinely just, that it didn't leave people behind, that it didn't leave people out of work. Because these are all the fears that some trade unionists have, in fairness, sometimes, some sections of trade union obviously organised in that industry.
Well, that's why you need the transition, isn't
it? Yeah, so you need to have a plan.
People who are working in the oil industry, etc., and get them
if you just leave it to the market to deliver a transition, well, A, I'm very doubtful whether it will be delivered at all. But let's just, let's play along for a minute and say, like, the transition could be delivered through the market. It would just be delivered in the same ways that the transition out of using coal was delivered, by destroying thousands and thousands of communities all over the country and hundreds of thousands of lives. Yeah. That's what's happening. I grew up in Ayrshire. I used to spend my youth racing bikes around South Ayrshire and all that, and right through these wee former pit villages and all that. And they were all in their knees. And that was in the '90s. Right. Even now, these villages haven't really recovered. And if they have recovered, it's only these commuter towns.
Yeah.
I mean that long term damage that's been done to people, the psychology and the geography of this country's out, and the economy, of course, is outrageous. And it could, we had to move away from coal, but it could have been done. Could have been done
an awful lot more differently.
Yeah, of course, it could have been done differently. Yeah. We need to learn from that. Yeah. I mean, although many people knew that at the time, of course.
And certainly for me, on that kind of publicly owned thing, is the railways.
Yes.
I mean, the railways were nationalised,
mm-hmm.
but they were nationalised because the private companies had stopped making profit.
Yes.
They weren't investing in it. They weren't investing in either the actual railways or the trains or anything, so the government had to take it over. And then they put out this stupid plan of, the franchises and everything, and that has definitely now totally and utterly proven that it doesn't work.
I mean, just on how railways got nationalised as well, I mean, yeah, they were formally nationalised during the Second World War, and then they kind of got, then afterwards. But people forget as well, the old railway boards that were set up pre Second World War was effectively a nationalisation. And that was done by a Tory government. That was done by Neville Chamberlain, no less, when he was Chancellor. As he did, incidentally, when he set up the electricity boards and the national grid. Because even he, as a Tory, albeit a slightly more patrician Tory than ever you find these days, but even he, as a Tory, understood that for the economy to move forward, you had to have one system of providing electricity that all businesses could tune into. I mean, literally in terms of frequency, in terms of voltage and all that stuff, and that would let the economy grow. That was it. It wasn't a benevolent exercise. It was raw economics. And so you don't have to be ideologically aligned to the idea of public ownership to know that it's a good thing. I mean, I'm ideologically aligned to it as it happens, but you don't have to be. You don't have to be. You should be able to look at what's going on right now in energy and understand. If you can't look at that and understand how that important that is to the national economy now, and that something as important as that can't just be left to the whims of the market. I mean, even as a right winger, surely you can understand that this state has to be involved in that. Surely.
Well, unfortunately, in my personal opinion, the politicians we have in power in Westminster at the moment don't think like that.
No.
They are thinking about their own personal finances their own personal profit and not the good of the country.
I think you're right. I think, you know, it's funny, we sometimes criticise them, saying, and I've done it myself, you know, say that, you know, the Tory government's ideological. I actually don't think they're ideological. I mean, you could point at Thatcher and say she was ideological, no doubt about that. But she made a lot of her friends and her family very, very wealthy in the process. Mm-hmm. The certainly the crop we've got right now, it's entirely about status, firstly.
Yeah.
And secondly, about making themselves and their friends very rich. And look at how rich George Osborne made his pounds over Royal Mail privatisation. Yeah. Although the funny thing is that everyone forgets that the 2010 general election, the only party that went into that election with Royal Mail privatisation in the manifesto was the Liberal Democrats.
Oh!
Everyone forgets that one. Yeah. So I'm not letting Vince Keeble off the hook for that. This is why, if you follow Dave Ward on Twitter, or CW on Twitter, they have a particular thing about winding up Vince Keeble. Whenever he has anything to say, they do tend to go for him. But it was literally in their manifesto. It wasn't even in the Tory manifesto. Oh, so the only things they got out of that coalition agreement was a 5p tax on plastic bags and Royal Mail privatisation. And I suppose we could say that they got a botched referendum on EV. But they're blowing success, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Certainly not for me.
Right, so thinking about what we're saying about power companies and stuff, you are helping to organise, certainly in Glasgow, the Power to the People campaign. And I've been out in protest with Scottish Power in Glasgow. So what do you think about this? We've talked about it already, but the energy companies and the corporations that are taking gas from the North Sea, and what should UK and Scottish governments be doing about the prices that we're paying at the moment?
Well, the short term thing we should do is there is a mechanism that could be used through the business department of the UK government. In terms of, they own a company that deals with settlements and sets prices, feed-in tariffs, etc. They can do something about that, because what's happening right now, and oddly enough, this is having a strange effect on things like wind, to use that as an example. So previously people who were providing power from wind were getting a preferential tariff to encourage. Well, theoretically.
As nuclear does, as far as I'm aware.
Yes, I'm just going to come to that. So they were getting a preferential tariff. The idea was to encourage investment out of that, the theory, right? So, but what's happened now is if you built yourself a new, you know, what's the collective noun for wind turbines? A flock? I don't know, mate. A farm, right? Built yourself a new wind farm, right? And you thought, I'm going to flog that to the, you know, flog that power to the grid. It's not worth your while signing on that deal previously, because you get so much more because the price has been pushed up to the international price of gas.
Yeah.
Right? And it's something similar has happened with nuclear, right? So they could, nuclear, the cost of providing energy from wind or nuclear haven't changed as a result of what's going on in the UK, right? It just hasn't happened, right? So what you could do is insist that they still sell things to the grid at that rate. Now, that's a short-term thing. I would far rather see these things come into public ownership, then we can deal with it a different way, but here and now, if you want to do it immediately, and this can be done through executive order, it doesn't take acts of parliament, it doesn't take anything, it just takes the minister to sign a form, right? And instruct some civil servants, and cost basically civil servants time. Right? This could be done. I mean, if you're talking about spending billions, this could be done for buttons, right? And it's not complicated at all. So they could change these tariffs. Now that affects roughly 60% of what's coming into the UK grid. So do that, you massively cut the price of what's going in there, and you cut prices immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, of course, there's the other 40% are in gas and all that takes other measures.
Yeah.
But you could do that. That could be done now. Right? Nobody's bothering. Right? Why are they not bothering? This is what we're asking. A lot of people are making a lot of money out of it, and they're enjoying that.
Yeah.
Right? And they're funding the government. And not in a good way. I don't mean funding the government through taxes. I mean funding the government through donations to the party. You know, I'm deeply cynical about how that whole system works. But see, that'd be the first act. I mean, if I was sitting in the minister's seat right now, that's the first thing I would do. Because you could do that, it would cost nothing, and have an immediate effect. And actually have alongside that, have a price cap that's meaningful. Right, we don't have a price cap that's meaningful right now. I mean, the idea of a cap is it's a cap. It isn't that it just keeps moving every couple of months when the energy companies fancy it moving. That's a joke. I mean, what's that? Well, that's not a cap.
Totally feels
it's not
the totally same.
What kind of a cap is that?
The first time I heard that the cap was being increased a bit, what? Sorry?
The cap should be set at a price at which nobody in this country should be in fuel poverty. That should be the defining way of calculating that. I get that's a difficult calculation because people live in different sizes of houses and blah blah blah, right? We know it's a complicated world out there, right? But if you're going to set it, it should be built on that. It shouldn't be built on a negotiation with the energy companies. You tell them what they're selling the market for. They don't want to sell in the market, they can bugger off. Mm-hmm. Because we're perfectly capable of self-sufficiency, even at UK, certainly at Scottish level, but even at UK level, it's perfectly possible.
Yeah.
Right? And you know, they can't just up sticks and take the gas fields with them. They can't up sticks and take the nuclear power plants with them. So they're not going to. Right? So we tell them they're not going to. This is what you sell. This is what you're selling to be good for. If you don't like it, off you go. We hand the keys back. Mm-hmm. That should be the attitude of government in a situation like this. That would be a clear line sent to the industry, sent to the markets, that we're not going to tolerate this. But also just doing what governments are supposed to do. We were told this years and years ago at school that apparently the first duty of a government is the security of its people. Mm-hmm. But people often think, when they think of that, they think of guns and weaponry and all this. This is security. This is security. Uh-huh. People are going to die this winter as a result of the cap being at the level it's at now, never mind what could happen next.
And I mean,
that's not security.
Uh-huh. We, as a nation, give licences to people to extract gas and oil from the North Sea. So we license them to do that. So we can tell them what to do or tell them to get lost.
Absolutely.
And
you need a government willing to stand up to them.
Uh-huh.
They're always scared of doing these things. It'll upset the market. It'll scare the horses, and people might not want to invest if you do that.
And again, the other thing I was going to say is market. It is a market.
Yeah.
Right. So if you go to a market, you trade with the person that's selling you something. They go, oh no, this is 60 quid. No, I'm only going to pay 20. So you don't just have to go with what it comes out. If it's a market, you can trade on that.
Indeed.
If you go, no, I'm not paying that.
The massive part, I mean, this is an issue within the NHS, change subject altogether, but within the NHS, historically in terms of drugs, we have not used our buying power properly there either, collectively. I mean, if you go back to, for anybody who's listening in, if you've not read In Place of Fear, do it. It's Nye Bevan's book, effectively, but it's a sort of biographical thing, but it talks about how he, from his point of view, how the NHS came together. And he talks about what his philosophy was behind it as well. Now, there's two things that have kind of sadly fallen by the wayside. One of them was people not having to declare their nationality before getting treatment. He's very clear about that. He said, are we going to be asking people for... literally says this. You're asking people for passports? Do we really think people are going to be tourists for us? And he said, this guy was writing this in 1951 or something. Right? It's as relevant then now as it is then. Because people are still coming up with the same nonsense then as they are now on that. But there's a similar thing. He said the next natural step was going to be a state pharmaceutical company.
Uh-huh.
Now, some of that would be about creating and developing and research, right, and manufacture. But some of it would also be about buying it collectively, because there'll be some stuff that you wouldn't necessarily always be able to do straight away. So you buy it in, and you buy it in with that buying power of an entire island, 60 million people or whatever that. It's obvious. You'd think governments, Tory governments who are apparently love the market and apparently know economics very, very well and know market economics very well, apparently would understand the concept of that, wouldn't you?
Yes.
But but strangely they don't, because what they're really about is greed. And what they're really about is making their friends very rich.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Everything there.
I've rambled on about this.
Oh, no, Craig, no, this is... right, what a hell of an odd question here on that. You are a member of the Labour Party.
So they say.
Yes. Yeah, and Labour Party is against independence for Scotland, pro-Brexit at the top. How do you feel about Brexit? Do you think it's working for the people of the United Kingdom? And what are, if you believe in it, what are the benefits of Scotland remaining in the Union with England?
Okay, well, on Brexit, it's not working. There you go. But it's reality, so we need to make it work. So I think there's things we can do to make it work. I'll give you an example. This is going back a couple of years now. Sat in the executive committee of the council here, and Susan Aitken, the council leader, quite rightly, was setting up an officer group to look into the challenges that were going to happen as a result of Brexit.
Mm.
So just so the council was prepared, it's all very sensible stuff, so we've got everyone in place, you know, trying to scope out what any risks might be. And I stuck my hand up, supporting her, I have to say. But I don't think she took it that well. I've spoken to her since. Anyway, I stuck my hand up and I said, well, actually, that's fine and it's sensible to have that kind of commitment, but we actually should be looking at opportunities as well. Because there are a couple, and quite obvious ones, I think, that whatever the other is, if you don't follow these up, then we're all worse off for it. So I think you need to try and make the best of the hands you're dealt with, whatever you think of Brexit, either way. And one of them is the issue of state aid. We were told for years that we couldn't enforce living wage end contracts. We could ask nicely, we could talk about fair work, all that kind of stuff, but we couldn't enforce it because that would be regarded as state aid. Now, we just had a discussion about this at the last pro-council meeting, and that the broad consensus about this across the party, isn't it? I mean, so there's two approaches that you take in that situation. You do insist upon it, and you just wait for somebody to sue you, and then just frankly publicly humiliate them for what to take to court to pay crap wages. Or you go down the fair work sort of strategy, which is more or less where the council's been, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
And generally in public sectors or something. But those state aid rules derived from European law. And for all the positives about Europe, we always need to kind of keep our wee sensible hat on here at times as trade unionists and as workers. There's a lot of things come out of Europe that we might have liked. Mm-hmm. There's actually a lot of things out of Europe that actually didn't work so well for workers. So the liberalisation of the postal market I was talking about earlier on did not work out very well, I don't think, for anyone.
Yeah, sure.
There's similar sorts of discussions you can have in other sectors. So there's things like that, and there's the rules are getting the rules preventing state aid, albeit we're quite often gold-plated by the UK government, as we said, because they always want excuses not to do it. But I think there's a possibility there that we can start pushing it out a little bit more. So I think that's so. Look, we are where we are. I hate saying that, but we are where we are. We're out of Europe. So how do we make? How do we? Our job now is how do we make this situation work? So I can't see a route, whether Scotland was independent or not. I can't see a route back into Europe very quickly. So and I think the EU project is imperfect anyway. So there's all sorts of issues around that. But I think we are where we are. The Tories, as ever, have made a complete arse of it. So I think we need to, we need to try and figure out how we make this work. And some of that is going to be about thinking about what we do about immigration, because as everyone's starting to realise, there's a shortage of, there's going to be a labour shortage. Or there is our labour shortage.
Oh, the devil, yeah.
I think we should revisit things like state aid, but we can also, there's other kind of bits and bobs around the edges that but we're always able to do this anyway, we never do it, go beyond European standards. Yeah, I think we should be looking for higher rather than just falling back on.
Yeah, there's so many things that we have always been able to do as a member of the EU, like the colour of the passports.
I mean, seriously, who gives a toss? I mean, it amazes me that anyone gave a monkey about that.
But that was one of the things that the champion. We didn't have.
I'd rather have a red one than a blue.
Never have to have. I don't care about the colour of the passport.
Quite like red, that's all.
I'd never have to have that red brown.
I'm going to be very liberal here for a moment. Just let people have a couple of passports they want.
In the EU, we could always have had it as a blue passport, and that is one of the, for me, the top line misleading thing that we were told.
There was a lot of misleading stuff all over the place there, but I think. And there's always been it's an interesting journey in terms of the trade union movement in Europe as well, obviously, because that's been, I suppose looking back, because obviously going in the 75 referendum, the trade union movement was more or less unanimously against, more or less, and the left, certainly the Labour Party was against, the SNP were against at that time. And obviously, bits of the Tory party was as spot as ever on that and all the rest of that. So, but what changed, oddly enough, was probably Thatcher, who was very pro going in, which is kind of one of the strange quirks of history, isn't it? Because it's basically her political children that got us out. It's a bizarre turn of events. But you go through the 80s, I mean, the trade union movement came to see Europe as something that was slowing Thatcher down in terms of the erosion of workers' rights and all that stuff, and came to see a possibility there for a means of kind of stopping her in her tracks. And I think that's why attitudes there started to change in terms. And in the left, more broadly, too, so I think that it's been a complicated picture. And I think I was interested in Johnny Thatcher herself. She went from wanting us to go into effectively won us out. Yeah. I take the view is that I don't think there's a possibility of a second referendum on Brexit anytime soon. So for at least a decade or so, so I don't think it's even worth at the moment. Almost, I don't think it's even worth discussing going back. I think we just need to knuckle down and try to make the bloody thing work. And I think the only way we can make it work is get rid of the people running the country. To be honest, it gives us our best chance.
Yes, indeed.
Right.
I think
that's not much comfort. I think
the left originally saw, and a lot of people still do, as the EU as a union of capitalists.
I think there's some truth in that, in fairness.
But there are so many other benefits with that: the workers' rights, the European Union. And human rights and stuff like that. It's complicated situation.
It's complicated, but I think we can. I haven't got to the second part of that, which is quite important. Right. Independence point.
Oh, yes.
Right, well, I don't support independence, but I do actually support the. I'm kind of nailed my colours to the mast on this. I ran for deputy leader of the Scottish Labour Party.
Mm-hmm.
And myself and Jackie Bailey were running against one another. And one of my key points about that was that the Labour Party's position on the second referendum was entirely wrong. And my view, I'm a Democrat, I believe in the concept, not the claim of right that's been talked about in the last few days, but slightly different. I think the more recent claim of right, the Labour Party signed up to that back in the day. I think that we should stick to that idea. So if the people of Scotland want a referendum on this matter, then we should have it.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, there's an argument could be had about how you demonstrate what the people of Scotland want, but here's and I was saying this 2 years ago, this was not, what's transpired since wasn't exactly, you didn't need to be Nostradamus to see how it was going to develop, right?
It seemed
quite obvious to me what was going to happen. So you got a pro-independence majority in Parliament, in Scottish Parliament, between the SNP and the Greens. They didn't need to be in coalition or cooperation agreements for that to be the case. That was going to be the case anyway, right? It was already the case before the election.
Uh-huh.
So it was entirely possible and feasible that there was going to be a move to a second referendum in this Parliament.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it's happened.
both those parties went to the people with that in the manifestos, as far as I'm aware. And they both then set about delivering that. So the vote, I don't believe the vote's actually going to Parliament formally yet, Scottish Parliament. But it will.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be amazing. As an aside, I don't think Nicola Sturgeon herself is particularly serious about having a referendum next year. That's just a personal view. But I think there'll be a push to do it. And it's an understandable push to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens then? So I was saying this two years ago. So I put this to Jackie Bailey Thames. Well, so what would the Labour Party do in that situation? Well, you don't. If you know there's going to be something down the track, and you know it's coming at you, you don't just stand there and wait for it to hit you.
Uh-huh.
Right? And I said, well, so we need to have a plan. What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. And the plan can't be just say no. It isn't a plan. I mean, it's nonsense.
Uh-huh.
And I really do. I mean, and I think there's a genuine confusion with some people who are against independence and think that to go along with the idea of another referendum is to go along with the idea of independence. Right? But for me, that's not the case. It might be for some people, but it's not for me. I'm first and foremost a Democrat. I can see my view of what should happen if there's a vote in Parliament on the matter. The will of the Labour Party, as decided at conferences and what have you, is that in that situation we'd probably vote against.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, to be fair, I don't know if all members in the Labour group would vote against that stuff, but we'll leave that sticking to the wall for now. Assume they all vote against. Fair enough, that's the right. Again, that's the platform they stood on,
yeah.
So that's reasonable enough. But if Parliament then makes a decision, the majority, you know, a motion is passed at Parliament, then I think there should be no debate at that point what side the Labour Party is on. And the Labour Party should be the side of Parliament. Or Scottish Parliament, I should. Right. It's perfectly obvious to me. You should be on the side of the Parliament, your Parliament that you fought to get and all that. Without going back to all that. You know, it's quite obvious to me. Because there will be a standoff was always going to happen.
Yeah.
Where you'd have a Tory government saying no and the Scottish government, a Scottish Parliament saying we want this.
Yep.
So in that side, what side do the Labour Party want to be on in that debate? I think it's perfectly obvious that I don't want to be on the side of a Conservative in every sense of the word government wanting to halt a debate.
Yeah.
You should be on the side of democracy. You should be on the side of your own Parliament.
Yep.
And stand by your own Parliament, even if it's not something you personally vote. I think there's a matter of principle there. I think that's the right thing to do. So that's what. So in that sense, if vote comes to pass. I'm still as it happens against independence, but I'm pro democracy. So I'm pro people of Scotland having the right to decide it and decide it on their own terms and to decide it at a time of their choosing.
Oh.
That's my view.
Good.
On independence itself, oddly enough, my reasons for being against independence are. If you like so I'll start with the heart first. Uh-huh. The heart is, I sort of wrapped up my politics a bit, but I look at the world through class first, and you'll hear this argument a million times, I'm sure. I find it really difficult to think of the idea of regarding the struggles of Scottish workers as separate from the struggles of other people on this island with a similar history and background. Mm-hmm. But I know these arguments can maybe do all over the world on this, right? So that's the kind of hard argument. And of course, like in terms of my family background, with all that kind of, I've got family, I'm married to somebody who's half Welsh, I'm a bit Irish, I'm a bit of an amalgam of heaven. And my daughter's just very confused, you know. It's a bit of that. That's the kind of heart argument for me. That's not the head argument. The head argument for me is more of an economic one. I'm deeply troubled by the. I mean, I was saying this in 2014 at the hustings when there was talk of when the plan that was getting mooted. By the mainstream campaign. I get that not everybody took this view. As you said, the Greens never took this view on currency.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of the currency union and all that stuff. I just thought, that's the worst of all possible scenarios. But you've gone independent, fair enough, and you have like a foreign bank dictating how much your country can borrow,
effectively, and what the supply of cash is in the uniform. I think I think that's absolutely insane. Oddly enough, I follow the sort of, I mean, yeah, there are other issues with this guy, but I mean, on this, I think you had a point. Jim Sillars at the time said, well, if you're going to go independent, well, you need to do it right. You know, you have, like, you have your own central bank and your own currency and all this. And, you know, there's a lot of talk right now. I mean, I'm getting a bit of a stushy on Twitter the whole day, but about what spending could be and couldn't be. But if for a government to have genuine power over its economy, and therefore genuine sovereignty, actually, because that's the way the world works, right? I'm a materialist. if a state doesn't have power over its economy, there's no power at all. That's just reality. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that central bank and all this stuff, and I don't see anything coming, any serious thing coming forward, putting that together, or even any acknowledgement of it. I mean, it's perfectly possible, of course, in this sense, not. But no acknowledgement of what you need to do to get there. Mm-hmm. See, I think there needs to be a bit of honesty and a bit of clarity about that, rather than actually. There's bits about the Yes Movement I don't get, which comes as a surprise to you.
Yeah.
And one of the bits about it is, and actually I find myself again with Pope like Jonathan Chaffee a lot on this stuff.
Uh-huh.
Which surprises him something. Surprises him more. I always think his contributions are very considered and come from a sort of honest place, if you like. And I don't agree with him and everything, but I think he thinks, you know, and he tries to think these things through. And I think he is absolutely on the button. Until that is sorted out, until there's a roadmap set out on how to do that, I don't think you're going to win people at the old. I can't do it. I couldn't do that at the moment. I think it caused too much difficulty and too much misery until I know there's a plan in place that is ready to roll. I'm not willing to take that away. So it's an economic judgment on that one.
Yep.
The other one is, I suppose this is really about arguments I'm against, really, arguments and for at this point. But it's been put forward as a means of getting back into the EU, and a bit like what I was saying earlier on, I think, of course it's perfectly possible to get into the EU, but the idea that it would happen quickly, isn't the case, because apart from anything else, you can't get into the EU while you're using another state's currency. So you need to even have your own, or adopt a euro beforehand, which I don't really know, and then you can't adopt a euro until you've got your own, so you're back to that again, right? The thing that frustrates me about that is, I'm not saying that any of these things are impossible, right? Of course they're possible, right? But they take time, they take effort, they take will, and they'll take, you know, a big collective effort to get them done, right? Fine. Doesn't mean they're impossible, they're not impossible. But what the bit that winds me up is that there's so much thought out there that off we go in independence and EU welcome us in because they love us. Well, yeah, I'm sure they do love us, but the world doesn't work like that,
yeah.
You know? And I think there needs to be just a wee bit more honesty and clarity about that debate. But in terms of staying in the United Kingdom, I think the United Kingdom is a deeply flawed thing. If you don't think it's a deeply flawed thing after what we've witnessed in the last few weeks, I don't know I am not for the status quo, I've never had been. I want to see something very, very different. But I want to see something very different that brings people together. I genuinely believe that. And I do, I know it's kind of much maligned turn of phrase, but I'll use it anyway. As a socialist, I want to see, as far as possible, resources shared. And when I hear people make arguments like, well, if you were off on your own, you know, or that we could have had all that other money or whatever, and that's all nice and good. But that doesn't help the guy in Liverpool, who's my cousin, you know, and worry. But equally, I think the biggest problem in terms of problem in terms of, if you like, separatism, to use that horrible word, in Britain and UK, is London. London is effectively, over these last 30, 40 years, has turned into a city-state. And the rest of the UK, and Scotland is just has been just part of that. But you can look at every part of the so-called periphery. Suffered at the hands of the City of London.
Specifically the City of
London.
Not Greater London, but the City of London.
Very specifically the City of London. And the thing, the tragedy about that is that those of us who are not part of that, have not been part of that wealth generating exercise for them. We've had our assets stripped. You know, where all the coal and the oil and everything was, basically all in manufacturing, all assets stripped. And then throw it in the winds under the in the Thatcher regime, where it was all about the assets, other types of assets, imaginary assets and property. And I think that's still the way our economy is run. It's still built around the City of London. And I want to see that smashed. I use that word quite specifically. I want to see the City of London smashed. Yeah. I think we should start with the City of London Authority. Actually. I think we break that first. But there's a serious problem with how our whole economy works. And I actually think if that gets fixed, then the alienation that we feel here in Scotland, that we feel, that actually many of my comrades in the North Island will feel as well, just as strongly, I have to say.
Oh, yeah.
And Wales, you know, they all feel it. And the working, and let's not forget the working class in London, who are completely priced out of their own hope.
Oh, yeah.
So that's how we need to remake that, we need to smash that.
I mean, I certainly say to folk often, and my opinion is that the City of London is the biggest offshore banking place in the world.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I mean, there was a sort of, you could see it sort of, this is when, I suppose, I don't know how it's going to work now, we're not in the EU. You could see what sort of happened in the EU during the 80s when it was going through a very, very important phase in its development. You had people like Coal and Thatcher and Mitterrand kicking around, right? Big characters in their own way. So basically what happened was that there was almost a tacit agreement about the division of labour within Europe. Germany would make things, France would grow things, and Britain would buy and sell imaginary things. That's basically what happened during those years. Right? And you can see some, the various parts of the mechanisms within the EU. You know, some of the subsidies about farmers, the French will always veto any changes to that because they've got such a big farming community and, you know, yeah, fair enough, you know, they've got to stick up for themselves.
Yeah.
Similarly, the Germans, you know, so when the euro currency came in, it really benefited Germany because it depressed the price, you know, the value of the currency they were selling in, so it helped them along. And, you know, and Britain got to have preferential access to the new euro markets. You know, it all worked along, it all toddled along sort of well with that sort of division of labour, you know, for the City of London.
Yeah.
But for the rest of us, not so much.
Right, well, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, that's been a pleasure.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure, anyway.
Yeah, so, good, and we'll talk again.
I hope so.
Right.
Thanks. Cheers.
A few quid keeps us going. Donate at paypal.me/ungagged left.